We'll start with Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, we had her before. She is the president of Solari Inc. and publishes the Solari Report. And she is also the member of Assistant Secretary of Housing and Federal Housing Commissioner at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. She was during the Bush administration. That is a Assistant Secretary. And now she is the Managing Director and member of the Board of Directors of the Wall Street Investment Bank, Dillon, Reed & Company. We have heard a lot about untruths, for instance, that the PCR test can't determine an infection, that we have a mortality rate of 0.5%, but we know that the measures taken to combat corona are having a huge impact, both social, medical, psychological. And the question is, how come have people become crazy? And Catherine Austin Fitz will tell us something about this. Catherine, ich spreche kein Deutsch, oder?
I used to speak German at the dinner table when they didn't want me to know what they were saying.
This was just a short introduction, but since we since you've been on our show already, I didn't need to go into any details. So let's just go right ahead.
Right, but before we go ahead, can I just thank you? This is my second time appearing, but I've watched many of your interviews, and I have to say, doing this open source investigation, you know, we all feel we've been on a journey with you, and it's been incredibly, incredibly productive. And I can't, you know, transparency is step one, and I think you've done as much as anybody to bring transparency, and I want to just say I'm deeply appreciative.
Thank you, Catherine. We appreciate your support as well. It can't work without us connecting and connecting with other people as well. But I think this seems to be working really well right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe because I think you're going to take a closer look at this sort of the plan or the, it's maybe more like the mindset behind what we can maybe see here, and you see, I think you're what you see as a driving motor basically of this whole thing is the transhumanist agenda.
So I've spent many decades trying to understand, you know, my nickname for the governance system of the planet is Mr. Global. And I've tried for many years to understand who is Mr. Global and why is Mr. Global doing what he's doing. And I just did a 2-hour Solari report basically covering all the theories, because the honest truth is I don't know. I can certainly share what I've experienced, but to me, one of the biggest issues in addition to who is Mr. Global is what is the risks that Mr. Global is facing. I believe because of what I've seen in the financial system for the last 3 decades, that one of the priority goals of Mr. Global is to engineer a multiplanetary civilization. And a lot of what we're watching in terms of central control is to help build the capital to manage that process and make that process go. And if that's correct, then the question is why? And I do believe that for the last 20 years, we've had a financial coup with extraordinary centralization of control of populations and resources. And it's gone far beyond what the general population has understood until the pandemic. One of the positive results of the pandemic is people are starting to dig and realize the extent to which the central control has been put in place. As we talked about the last time I was here, we've had a baby boomer population going through the global demographics, and there is no doubt. I believe two decades ago, starting in 1998, that we began a process called the financial coup d'etat, where all the funding that had been accumulated to support the baby boomer generation in their retirement was essentially being moved out of the sovereign governments. The sovereign governments were being levered up with debt so that essentially this 100-year balance of power between the central bankers and the sovereign governments could be resolved by the central bankers taking over the treasury and fiscal function, which is where we are now. So we've had a financial coup, the boomers have been promised a great deal in the, particularly in the G7 nations. That money has essentially been stolen. And the question is, you know, how is Mr. Global going to resolve and abrogate all the contracts and re-engineer the sovereign governments? And of course, that generates huge amounts of unanswered questions. We can all guess, but the reality is we don't know. And it comes back to, you know, what are Mr. Global's goals other than complete central control, because the technology allows that to happen, or you know, somebody clearly thinks that it will permit it to let it happen. What is his goals, and or what are their goals, and what are the risks they're managing? And then how do we somehow provide alternatives? I would say that one thing I wasn't clear about when I last interviewed with you is that what is happening now is a genocide. We have been watching in the United States for several decades what I call the Great Poisoning. And the Great Poisoning is a series of different things that's generally poisoning the population, either suppressing their immune system or increasing toxicity. And then people die of what they're weak. It doesn't look like an epidemic, but it is. If you look at what we do know so far about the COVID-19 injections, they seem to be radically accelerating the Great Poisoning. And it's clear to me that the sort of the death and the disability resulting from them is more much more significant than whatever is happening from what the phenomena called COVID-19, which seems to be a relatively complex phenomena. But the injections are far more dangerous. And so I wrote an article in the beginning of the pandemic called The Injection Fraud, and I continue to think, you know, before us, we need urgently to stop the mandates for the injections, because too many people are being harmed and harmed in very gruesome ways. But the other thing we need to do is stop the vaccine passports, because when the passports go into effect, we will be subject to a tyranny that will accelerate the evil that can be done to us. What we're dealing with is nothing compared to what will happen if the passports go into effect. And it's extremely important to understand that the passport system has been put into place for the last 20 years. We have in the West a very deep, complex, invasive social credit system already operating on a covert basis. If you get overt approval of the passports, the speed at which that covert social credit system can go into effect will dazzle you, because it's already in effect on a covert basis. The vaccine passports just give us the ability to take it overt. And so whether it's stopping the harm done by the mandates, helping the people who've already been harmed, which is very, very important. We have many, many people who are in real jeopardy from a health standpoint. Or, and this is the last thing, if you look at who's financing this genocide, it's us. And so I just launched yesterday with Polly Tommy on the Children's Health Defense TV, a 15-minute weekly show called Financial Rebellion. We have to unleash a financial rebellion if we're going to stop the mandates and stop the vaccine passports. Because right now we are financing and building this prison, and we have the power to stop.
Can you, so when, sorry, when, if the passports go into full bloom, what is it you expect is going to happen, like immediately and in the long run? So it's going to be total control, like for everything.
It's going to be total health control. So if you look at some of these vaccine passport apps, they envision 7+ boosters. And that's important, because we do not know what are in these injections. So we have a secret governance system injecting secret ingredients into our bodies. We know some things about the injections and what's causing harm, like the spike protein and the lipid toxicity. But there's clear evidence that there are secret ingredients, and we're not allowed to have informed consent because we're not allowed to know what's in it. And I think if there's one dominant unanswered question of the pandemic, it's what are the secret ingredients? What is in this stuff? And I don't presume it's just one batch. It's, you know, multiple batches in multiple places. But what is in this stuff? And why does Mr. Global want it in? Because I think, you know, we mentioned transhumanism when we started. My guess is those secret ingredients are going to tell us a lot about what transhumanism is being tested, experimented, envisioned, and where it's leading. And of course, I believe where it's leading is Mr. Global wants a slavery system where humans are essentially, you know, linked into the machine instead of linked into the divine in each other. So we're resonating with their machines as opposed to resonating with life. So that's always been my guess here. But to me, you know, I'm very big on unanswered questions. What are the unanswered questions that we need to bring transparency to? One of the most important is, what are these secret ingredients? Because if you just look, so for example, the Japanese found steel particles. Why are we injecting steel particles into people's bodies?
Yeah, one of our scientists found these steel particles as well.
Right.
But, you know, he believes that maybe this is due to the manufacturing process, that it was sloppily done, but he's not sure. So that's, to him too, that's another unanswered question.
So if it was one researcher, but I've had multiple researchers report steel particles. And what I will say, if there's anything I've learned about what I call, we did a 12-part series on the Slater Report called Deep State Tactics. And two of the most effective deep state tactics that I have ever encountered is, one is, we're incompetent, we made a mistake. You know, I can't tell you how incompetency is used effectively. You know, for 20 years, the federal government can't produce audited financial statements as required by law, but oh, it's because they're incompetent. The second thing is, it's complicated. You know, it's really very complicated, and it's really great. You know, and between incompetency and complexity playing off against each other, you know, for example, I'll give you a perfect example. If you look at, I just published a review of Kennedy's incredible book on Fauci. And one of the reactions I'm getting from people when they read that book is they're saying, how could all of this been going on and me not know? And if you go back and you look at the coverage of the AIDS epidemic or swine flu or all the different things documented in that book, I can't tell you how many of those were covered up with, we made a mistake, it's really complicated. You know, it's been going on for years in both the health and the financial area.
Do we in effect have two different governments? The people who are running the show behind the scenes and those who are acting as their puppets, so to speak.
So here's the thing to understand. There are no governments. There are no governments. You know, there are governments as a technical legal matter, and the funding goes to the government. But here's, you know, so I'll use the U.S. government, which I understand. For a government to be sovereign, it has to have financial sovereignty, and it has to have information sovereignty, and it has to have a decision sovereignty. So I have to be able to say no without the bankers pulling my money and putting me in a position where I can't send checks to the taxpayers and the citizens. So we don't have financial sovereignty. Part of levering up the governments is putting them in a debt trap. And it's been done to the selected part of the population, too. So one, you don't have financial sovereignty. Two, you don't have information sovereignty. When I became assistant secretary, I would regularly try and get data from corporate contractors that was required for me to run my operation according to the law. So according to the law, the mortgage insurance single family fund in the United States is supposed to be run on a self-sustaining basis. That is the law. I could not get from Lockheed Martin the data I needed to tell whether I was making or losing money. I finally had to have the accountants moved over to report to me and do estimations so I could basically try and implement the law. But I can't tell you the food fights I had with corporate banks and corporate contractors who would refuse to give me the data because they didn't want me to know what was going on in the operation because it was clearly outside of the law. The third thing you need is you need decision sovereignty, So let me step back on the information sovereignty. We've seen story after story of a president trying to have a private phone call with another global president and not being able to have a private phone call. And it's getting leaked to the New York Times, et cetera, you know, by the intelligence agencies. And this comes back to the IT systems, which are now clearly under control of both intelligence agencies and their corporate contractors. The third thing is a sovereign government needs the ability to make decisions. So I need to be able to say no to big pharma without my children, you know, being killed or me having a car accident. And at this point, the covert operations are significant and out of control. And that includes generating control files on massive numbers of people. You know, I was told very clearly by the cabinet secretary I worked for, who used to keep ordering me to obey the law. It was disobey the law. I refused, which is why I had to leave. But he would basically tell me, you know, I'm going to find dirt on you and basically expose you unless you do what I say. You know, and what was very interesting is when I ended up being targeted by the Department of Justice, I think part of the problem was if you don't have a control file, they'll just make one up. And I spent 11 years and $6 million, you know, working for free for 11 years is a lot. And I spent 11 years and $6 million proving that they had nothing. And not everyone, particularly people with a large family, can't afford to do that. So financial sovereignty, information sovereignty, decision sovereignty, one of the things we need to grapple with, because I think the government is like a football, and we want to get the football back. The central bankers are now taking over the treasury function and the taxation flow. This is all going to come down to taxation without representation, which is what I'd like to talk about and how the vaccine passports fit into that. But the central bankers are taking over the treasury function worldwide, and I think we need to take it back. In other words, I think we want to return sovereignty to government and get the balance of power between the bankers and the governments back, you know, back in favor of people having a say in a democratic process as to how their world is run. But this all comes down to, you know, it's good you bring up transhumanism. Do we want to have a human civilization, or do we want to have a transhumanist civilization where instead of us being sovereign individuals under divine authority, you know, we're livestock, you know, that resonate with the machine because we've had digital technology poured into our body one way or the other?
Let me, like one step, because you just mentioned this financial constellation together with the, you know, the vaccination passport. I remember like a few years ago, there was some activity in, I think it was in Africa, where they were offering also the vaccination passport that could also serve as a credit card. I think it was a payment tool. So I think that's the point. That's what they're going to be suggesting or like introducing.
Well, if you look around the world, you know, oftentimes those systems are not being run by the health ministry. They're being run by the financial ministry. I mean, this is a control grid. What they are putting into place is a smart grid control grid. They are ending currencies as we know it and instead putting in a financial transaction control grid. And the vaccine passports and central bank digital currencies are two pieces of what's already been built. I want to stress the covert social credit system and smart grid has been significantly built, and 5G is a very important piece of putting it into place. But when it snaps together with the vaccine passports, taking the existing social credit covert side over, and then you add in central bank digital currencies, what you will see is a complete control where they can not only ask you to take 7 boosters full of stainless steel particles or whatever the secret ingredients are, but they can literally come into your house and take your kids. Say, you know, we feel you're not raising them. We would prefer raising them ourselves or using them in a variety of ways. And so we're just going to take them.
Well, it's crazy.
And it is all going to be... Go ahead, Viviane.
No, Rainer, you say.
No, I just wanted to say this COVID passport or the vaccine passport, that is the most important tool that they need in order to gain full control over us.
They need, first
or rather,
of all,
as you said, this is the overt part of the whole deal. It's been going on covertly for quite a while, right?
Right. This allows them to take the covert social credit system in the West overt and do it globally. Mm-hmm. And so when you want to stop that, you also want to stop central bank digital currencies, but the passport's going to go in first. And so it's absolutely essential to stop the passport, and then you're still going to have to grapple with the central bank digital control or currency. Let me make a recommendation. We have just successfully stopped the nominee for bank regulator in the United States. Was a Cornell law professor who wrote an article in the Vanderbilt Law Review that was published in October 2021. It was just published 1 or 2 months ago. And it describes taking all the bank deposits in America and moving them from the banks. You basically extinguish the entire banking system and you put it at the central bank. And the paper describes the fact. So that's $18 trillion moved out of private banks and credit unions, boom, right onto the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. And then the description is, the great thing about this, if inflation starts to take off, which it has, particularly, I don't know if you've looked at the German producer price index lately, but it's taken off. If inflation takes off, you can just shut off their bank accounts. And this is what is proposed. So, you know, luckily we were able to get that candidate killed. But once you have central bank digital currencies and vaccine passports in place, you can have taxation without representation. And when I say taxation, I don't mean they can just take a portion or a higher portion of your income. I mean they can take your assets, they can take your children, they can deny you any kind of service. I mean, we are talking about, I keep saying this word, but I want to underscore, we're talking about a slavery system.
And, you know, I think also because there's already talk that there's so many like vaccination passports now, or like these vaccination papers that are now, you know, people are faking them. And, you know, there's already this kind of discussion. So obviously they need to move further and get this passport in under your skin. You know, like it's either like you're identified by your iris scan, or like what's even more likely, that it's maybe something that you get with the vaccination, you know, that you can show, oh, that's me, and I want to buy this piece of this piece of bread or something like that. So I think it's really, that's the next step, that it's moving under your skin, this identification system. I think
step one of the financial rebellion has to be to refuse an all-digital financial system and an all-digital communication system. You know, digital technology holds out wonderful, fabulous promise, but if you look at how it's being applied, you know, it's a tool. And if you have a governance system which does not have your best intention at heart, then powerful tools like digital technology can be used for ill and not for good. So this is why, you know, we have to grapple with who in the world is running these things and why are they behaving the way they're behaving? And, you know, and so bringing transparency to that and to the secret ingredients are, to me, two of the most important issues. I think and write a lot about what kind of financial system could work for us. And what I keep coming back to, I just published an article about a book review of a book on currency systems in ancient cultures, because I've been trying to go back through history and see what worked and what didn't. And what you discover again and again and again, the thing that makes a currency great is the rule of law and a covenant within the society to manage itself and its resources according to the rule of law. And there are no solutions. You know, it's funny, I'm saying this as an investment banker to a group of attorneys. There are no solutions without the rule of law. And that's the question. How are we going to bring transparency and then enforce the rule of law? Because basically we have a planet being run by criminals, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse and worse as the secret money has grown. There's a real correlation between the growth of secret money, including in the United States, and the growth of organized crime globally, and the power of their invisible weaponry and tools. But it's all going to come back to, okay, you know, how do we enforce, nurture, and support the rule of law, because until we do that, no financial system is going to work. And I don't want to, you know, gold's not going to do it. Blockchain's not going to do it. You have to have the rule of law.
Yeah, definitely.
I absolutely agree. I'm actually quite frustrated, is not the right word, angry, I don't know, that in Germany, the rule of law is completely destroyed. I mean, nothing works anymore. There's only something going on the surface, but this is only to keep people, to give them the illusion that some parts of the judiciary are still working.
Right. So here's what's happened. You have government officials, you have judges, you have policemen who have the same sovereignty issue. They don't want their children killed. They don't want to lose their ability to support their family. So everybody's, you know, I'm going to grossly oversimplify, everybody's in a situation of blackmail and threat for their life. And so they're behaving this way. And the reason the corporations who and banks who would love to sort of take over and run everything are leaving the sort of blackmailed judiciary and the blackmailed government in place is they're not yet in a position to implement taxation without representation. So they need the appearance of a government and the budget of a government to keep taxing and regulating. And the danger, of course, is when they get the vaccine passports, if we don't return the governments to some kind of position of sovereignty, we'll have something far worse, which is, you know, control by a very centralized group of people who are implementing it through corporations and banks. And if you think if you have a problem with the civil service, where do you see those things implemented with a corporation and bank? And then we're in Never Never Land. So before that happens, what we have to figure out is how to shift our tax money back to lawful governance and management, and how to start protecting government officials so that they can implement the rule of law.
I
think it's the only way.
I'm really curious about this, the attitude behind this transhumanist aspect, you know, that maybe we can talk a little bit about that as well. And, you know, and then maybe come back to the solution parts again, because I think that's very interesting what you've been thinking about that. And maybe could you elaborate a little bit, because I think it's also not like an obsession. It's some kind of obsession,
right?
You know?
So I have a couple of theories and I'll just share them.
Yeah.
One is, I think if you are looking at the entire planet from a very, you know, high level, and you're in the process of bringing automation in, and you believe, which they do, that you can replace every existing job and employee with robotics and automation, you have a real question. How am I going to integrate robots into the labor force? And if you sit down and you look at what it would take to create two labor forces, one human and one robotics, and you had to invent globally new law, new regulation to manage the robots and keep the existing laws of managing people, that would cost trillions of dollars and take, you know, decades. But if you can integrate robots into the existing system, it's much more efficient. One of the reasons it's much more efficient is there is a continuum from what is a human to what is a cyborg to what is a robot. So we're seeing doctors around the world, you know, replace amputated parts of people's bodies with robotics, and, you know, it's working wonderfully for those people. So you have this continuum of integration between robotics and humans. And so you say, look, it's going to get wildly complicated. Why don't I just integrate everybody to the existing labor system? And I think a lot of the really bizarre transhumanist things we're watching comes from that. So theory number one is, it's much more efficient from a labor management standpoint to integrate robots into one existing system with humans as opposed to have two systems. That's number one. And that gets us deeply into taxation, which I want to come back to. The second thing is, once you have CRISPR technology, in my experience, the people who are at the top of the food chain in the United States believe tremendously in the power of genes. And so there's a long history of what I'll call special breeding programs. And you know, whether it's people or racehorses or, you know, fancy dogs, that they take very, very seriously. They invest an enormous amount sort of personnel management. And I think once CRISPR technology came into being, they suddenly realized, you know, we can control centrally what genes come into the world rather than have, you know, a man and woman get together and have, you know, let nature decide what genes come into the world. And so the idea of de-sexing the population and then, you know, I don't know if you've seen the advertisements of literally, you know, your baby is incubated in an incubator sitting in your living room. I mean, you know, so I think there's a desire to take control of who can have children and what genes they're allowed to bring into this world is part of this. And I think the third thing you brought up earlier is if you can disassociate people from their body and the real world, they're much easier to mind control, they're much easier to control, they're much easier to harvest. So when the World Economic Forum says it's 2030 and you know, you have no assets and you own nothing and you're happy, what I hear is, you know, we put the vaccine passports in place, we stripped you of all your assets, and now you're totally mind controlled. So I think those are some of the issues. Now, there's a third economic issue, which is very important to understand. And that is, if you understand the competition to win in the race to develop AI and literally manage the planet with AI, what you will see is the person or the company or the country that produces the best AI is the one that has the most data. In other words, great AI is not created by software developers. Great AI is created by essentially a feedback loop between data and the data generates the intelligence of the software. I'm grossly oversimplifying again. And so you see this race. We mentioned James Corbett, who has a wonderful Corbett report on data is the new oil, but you see this race to suck up as much data as possible. Asia has a tremendous advantage because it has a much bigger population. And so part of the effort in the West has been to literally digitize everything, digitize the trees, digitize the animals, digitize all the material that we create, put digital technology into humans, digitize the atmosphere. I mean, there is a race to digitize everything on the theory, then you can hook it all up to AI and use telecommunications to understand your world and manage the risk. You know, I keep coming back to the fact, in my experience, the people, literally the top leadership in America was phenomenally oriented to managing risk. And there's no doubt that if you can get everything digitized and literally constantly map, you know, all reality and all life, you know, it can certainly help you understand and manage risk. The problem is you end up using the tools for control and control to protect your leadership. And the next thing you know, you've killed meritocracy. And right now we're on a terrible downward slope in terms of productivity. Because the more you centrally control, the more you cut off the oxygen that creates open source intelligence. You know, markets and democracy are very messy, but they are brilliant at creating open source intelligence and improving the health and vitality of the culture. And of course, the more you engineer central control, the more you engineer privilege, and the more that privilege is used to literally destroy the economy, you know, but make a few people very, very rich. I just heard Kennedy say that we've created 500 new billionaires since the pandemic started. Not surprising. My guess is it's more.
But here we have a citation here from Sean Parker, former president of Facebook said in 2017 in an Axios interview, because I'm a billionaire, I'm going to have access to better healthcare. I'm going to be like 160 and I'm going to be part of this class of immortal overlords. Give us billionaires an extra 100 years and you'll know what wealthy disparity looks like. So it also right. seems to be like the dream of like an endless life, immortal, and sort of like an Übermensch kind of crowd that controls the rest of the creeps. Or
so I suspect part of the genocide is not just that you've stolen the retirement savings, but part of the genocide is if you're going to expand the life expectancy in the top 1% of 1%, you need to lower the life expectancy, in the bottom. And they don't want to the responsibilities of managing an ever larger population. So they do expect to use this technology to live forever. And the problem is, the reason to have complete control physically of a population and reduce them to slavery is because once they realize how much money you've stolen and once they realize, that they're using the technology to live for 140, there's nothing more gruesome than looking at people who cannot afford to feed their children, taking their children down to a center to give blood so that a Silicon Valley executive can refresh their blood with young blood, and it was that company, that Silicon Valley company, that had a lot to do with stealing all the federal monies that, of course, has reduced the economy of the person who now has to give. It's a vampire model financially, but then literally with the blood.
Wow.
You've mentioned this a few times, that so much money was taken out of the system, both out of the American system, but also out of the European system. And I think if I remember correctly, this happened towards the end of the 1980s. And in both cases, it was roughly an amount of, was it 60 or 61 trillion dollars or euros?
So here's what happened. Mm-hmm. There was a budget deal that busted in 1995 in the United States in October of 1995. I was told by one of the president of the largest pension fund in the country that essentially at that point, they have given up on the country and they're moving all the money out. Okay. The next month, November 1995, after the budget deal busted, is when OxyContin was approved and the predatory lending skyrocketed. Interestingly enough, under Andrew Cuomo, who also had something to do with getting the pandemic going. So the policies, somebody hit a switch and switched to accelerated the great poisoning was on, both financially and in health. And it started with a vengeance in November 1995. In October 1st, 1997, vast amounts of money started disappearing from the U.S. government. We've now documented undocumentable adjustments of $21 trillion, but there's evidence to suggest it's much greater. And I assure you, with Treasury and securities fraud, there's a near infinite amount of money that can be stolen. Anyway, that started in 1997, and it had become an explosive issue politically. I was working on a major expose that was scheduled to be published 4 days after 9/11 and published in Washington in a way that it went to all the senators' desks. At that point, there was $4 trillion missing. When 9/11 happened, it blew up. The different offices that were doing the investigation, both in New York and Washington, were told of the offices that were investigating the $4 trillion and to try and get it back. And so you had a huge, not only cover up the money that had gone missing at that point, but an acceleration of the theft that could continue because of the Patriot Act and the other sort of laws that facilitated central control and the ability to strip sovereignty. I mean, it's the stripping the sovereignty. We were off to the races. And then as of 2015, there was an announcement of a new round of money gone missing. At that point, I was documenting and doing radio shows on this regularly. And if you go to missingmoney.solari.com, there's great documentation. 6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments in 2015 at the end of the Obama administration. A professor, Dr. Mark Skidmore, heard me describing this, and being a professor of economics, said she has to be wrong, because that's so many more multiples than the entire federal budget. You know, at that point, I think Department of Defense budget was about $600 or $700 billion. Now it's almost $800 billion on the overt side, covert much more. Anyway, he dug into the financial statements and realized I was right, and called me and said, "Is there anything I could do to help?" And I said, "Yes, I've never done a full, complete survey of all the financials at HUD and DOD over this period. If you could get your students and do a survey," he did, and published a series of reports documenting $21 trillion missing. Then in October of 2018, the federal government, both the Senate, the House, and the White House working together, adopted a policy, and you'll find all of this described at missingmoney.zolari.com, called Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56. I call it FASB 56. It is a administrative policy that has not risen to the level of law or regulation, let alone constitutional amendment. And what it says is the federal government can keep secret books by a secret process run by a secret group of people. In other words, the financial system at the federal government, both Treasury and central bank, is completely 100% out of control. No disclosure. They can do whatever they want. They can spend it on whatever they want. And I believe, I would absolutely bet you a euro that the pandemic could never have happened if they hadn't been able to turn on that spigot. It was interesting, right? Literally the month after they turned on that spigot, Moderna was able to raise, I think, $500 million. You know, and I would have told you, looking at their balance sheet and their finances and management, no one, you know, no investor worth his salt would put a dollar in, let alone $500 million. So, you know, the question is, where did that money come from? And if you look at a lot of the money, you know, the day the money started to go missing, I had been Assistant Secretary of Housing at HUD, and money started going missing in vast amounts at HUD, which is how I discovered this and how we initially got onto it. And the minute, Reiner, that money started going missing from HUD, suddenly all the, you know, you had firms like Carlyle and Washington suddenly raising billions of dollars with no history or experience in this kind of investment. And everybody in the investment world was like, how did those guys raise $1 billion to invest in China? You know, what's the miracle here? Where'd this money come from? You know, my big question now is, you know, and it's the same now, you see private equity firms buying everything up around the globe like a global sweepstake, just as the Fed is doing the going direct quantitative easing, massive amounts of money showing up in all these, you know, places. So what happened after 2015 is basically we went into a complete secrecy about the money. There is indications that the adjustments may be up to 90 trillion, but we can't prove that those are undocumentable adjustments, and we don't trust any of their numbers anymore. What I will tell you is people always try and, you know, the spin back is, oh, the $21 trillion is just accounting errors. That's ridiculous. I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing. I spent, you know, a long time and a great deal of money implementing perfect accounting systems, perfect accounting regulations, perfect accounting, you know, everything at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and making sure the resources were there. There is not one reason on the planet that as of 1998, HUD should not have had absolutely perfect books, you know, with undocumentable adjustments of no more than $1 million.
Yeah, I know. Just, I mean, that's really in absolutely unbelievable. I mean, that's impossible, basically, that you'd have like a larger financial, bookkeeping. I'm sure there are departments, obviously in these. And that's impossible. But, that's crazy.
But Vivian, the civil service is incompetent and it's very complicated. And we have these systems and it's very complicated and we're all incompetent. And right?
It's crazy.
It's always the same story, always the same explanation. But it's a very simple system then. It's just like Corona. It's everything is right in front of you. If only you could use your head, you would see immediately what's going on. What they did is they stole the taxpayers' money by creating agencies and entities like after 9/11 and pushing the money into this new system where it disappeared and then was forwarded to enterprises like Carlyle and others.
So you're bringing down the old. It's a coup. It's a financial coup d'état. You lever up the governments. You put the money in your new system, which you control, and you slowly enervate and bankrupt the old system, but you use it to keep control.
And you think it was? I mean, because you mentioned like covert budgets before. You know that existed prior to that moment. Do you think they were just not sufficient enough, or it was like too complicated to work with all these covert budgets, so they had to go overt at some point?
I think that's an excellent question. And my answer, grossly oversimplified, is yes. So at the end of World War II, they created the 47 and 49 Act. And I have an online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, that explains this. And in fact, next week, we're just about to publish it next week or the week after in German. It's in French and Spanish. But so we created the 47 and 49 Act, which created the black budget. And we took the money seized at the end of World War II and put it in a hidden system of finance that you could use with that black budget, as well as the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which we created in 34. But then what you did in 81, when the Bushes came, and the Bushes were masters of this, they created an executive order that said private corporations and banks can do highly classified functions. Well, then you've got the treasury market, both overt and covert, able to pump an infinite amount of money into publicly traded stocks. Well, then you're off and running with the military-industrial complex. And what happens is you engineer more and more laws, classification laws, national security directives, and now FASB 56, that allows you to keep all the money secret and to do amazing things. So I have an article, that, and you can link to it from missingmoney.salieri.com, called Caveat Emptor, which I wrote with my attorney to help people understand, you know, who are managing retirement savings or positions in treasuries, what this means to their credit. In other words, you now have created a situation where the vast majority of the U.S. securities market has no transparency or no correct transparency or no meaningful transparency, because national security law has basically allowed all of these different shenanigans and secrecy to go on. And so it is impossible if you're an investor to understand, you know, sort of what the credit is behind a U.S. Treasury, other than to assume all the assets you financed have disappeared into another system. I think it was 2012, one of the rating agencies in the United States tried to drop the rating of U.S. Treasuries. They and their parent company were attacked by the Department of Justice. The president of the company lost his job. He was fired. And basically they had to, you know, the company was almost destroyed as a result of doing that. And now no credit agency dares to question the, you know, the treasury, or no American credit agency dares to question the U.S. Treasury credit. So we wrote Caveat Emptor to help the investors understand what they're grappling with.
How did they go about shifting the money here in Europe, shifting it from our taxpayers' coffers to their entities? Was that done through NATO? I think
so
NATO played a big part in it.
The only money I've found disappearing in Europe, and I haven't looked carefully, was in NATO, which I found when I was still looking at the missing money. Yeah. You had a Dutch auditor who highlighted the fact that there was shenanigans going on in the books. And my guess is if you go back in NATO, you'll find enormous shenanigans. If you look at the condition of the European infrastructure and system, it looks to me like a lot more money in Europe has gone into basic governmental purposes than disappearing. I mean, it's very obvious when you drive around the United States that the money has not gone to the governmental purpose. So you have a tremendous deterioration in infrastructure and other systems that you don't see in Europe, particularly in Northern Europe. You see it more in Southern Europe. So I don't know about the European governments. What I can tell you is that, you know, there was clearly funny business in NATO. And I think, you know, it's funny because the U.S. securities market has and stock market has significantly outperformed the European stock market. I suspect a lot of that is these kinds of shenanigans. And there are, I know a fair amount of investors who, despite the outperformance, continue to prefer European equities because they believe at least the earnings are closer to real.
But Al, you know, we've spoken, you know, Leslie Manoukian, she's yes. a former investment banker. And yeah. She says she took, and she spent some 10 years in Europe, I think mostly in, right. in London, but also in Germany, I believe. And she says that one of the reasons why they're pushing so hard, in particular in Europe, is because Europe is completely broke. The pension funds are completely empty. All of the money that should have gone to, well, let's say the support of the baby boomer generation, all of it was probably through NATO, maybe other, maybe there's other vehicles that they use, but it was taken from the public and then shifted to these private entities that you mentioned.
That's but very, it should, it, it, it's very mm-hmm. possible, especially if they're full of sovereign government bonds, when the governments mm-hmm. have been denuded of their assets or in debt. So if I fill up a pension fund, you know, whether in Europe or the United States, with sovereign government bonds, and I've stolen the assets from those governments that, you know, that were purchased with the proceeds from those bonds, you know, then my retirement funds are full of bonds, but essentially they're, you know, they're next to worthless. Now, let me just say, because, you know, if you listen to me, you could get depressed, but I will make this argument again and again. If you have a system, when you centralize control in the way that we're doing it, you destroy the vitality and the productivity of the economy. And you have what I call a negative return on investment economy. What I did when I left the Bush administration is I created a company called Hamilton Securities, and we built relational databases that let us look at the economy on a place-based basis, and to simulate how much wealth could be created with the blessings of new technology if we were to enhance the productivity of people and places and living things, and build an economy where the financial system and the environment have a win-win relationship. Right now, the financial system and the environment and living things have a win-lose relationship. But if you re-engineer to a win-win, how much wealth could be created? And the little secret here is the wealth that can be created is absolutely fantastic, but you're going to have to go to a governance system that is not secret and is not, you know, that is a meritocracy. And so what I discovered is it seems like there's not enough money and everybody's bankrupt as long as you have a negative return on investment system. But if you will switch to a positive return on investment system, you know, there's a lot of hope, because then you're talking about, you know, the economics dramatically improving wealth. Now, given how much money's stolen, I don't know where it's gone, what it's in, et cetera. You know, can you get that money back, or do you have to generate new wealth? I don't know. So there's absolutely, there's been a shift. But the idea that things are hopeless because we have a negative return on investment economy when we could convert to a positive return on investment economy, it's kind of like, you know, it's, I don't know if you ever saw the American movie Animal House, you know, but if everybody's behaving badly, there are no solutions. But if everybody starts behaving productively, there are real solutions. Are we going to have to tighten our belts? Absolutely. You know, one of the ways we got into this, because there's a, you know, everybody has a desire to say, oh, this happened because the top guys are bad guys. You know, let me just say, as an American, I've explored the depth of the corruption at the, you know, at the all the way bottom up, and the bad behavior and the dependency on, you know, the clear message of the American voting population is keep the war and the financial fraud and the organized crime going because it makes us money. Just give me a story of I am good, but I want the money and I want to be able to pretend I'm good. And the reality is, the corruption is not just at the top. The corruption is throughout the society. So we're all
very visibly now.
Right.
Very visibly now, because if it wasn't for the corruption in the lower ranks, so to speak, this whole thing wouldn't have been, so they couldn't have pulled it off.
So I'm going to say a very tough thing, but I'm a big believer in tough love. What I studied for many years is how can 70% of Americans say they're Christian and our number one business is war and organized crime? How can that be? How can this be engineered? And what I discovered, I came up with something called the story of I am good. What everybody in America wants is a story of why I'm good and I can keep taking the money. So I can go to work for a pharmaceutical company that's engineering death and I can take the check and still feel good. Or I can put my money in their stock and I can still feel good about myself. So everybody wants the story of I'm good. It's not me. It's him who's doing it. Mr. Global's the bad guy. But, I hate to say this. If you're going to march people into gas chambers, then you have to face you're doing genocide. But if you can give them an injection that poisons people slowly, invisibly, that's their story of I am good. And we have doctors and nurses all over the world and paramedics who are basically marching people into gas chambers, and they're doing it because they have a story of I am good. And I think a lot of them know it's just a cover story. Some of them believe it, but not everybody. But they believe as long as they have, the injection is the new story of I am good.
Yeah, I mean, that's also even perverted, like obviously, like in the communication that you it's an act of solidarity. And so, they're pushing also that button on the people. So
right.
That's, I mean, as
right.
We can
I can
see.
Feel good about killing you. I'm helping you. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, right.
There's a long, since the 47 and 49 Act went into place, there is a long history of the evolution of the story of my good. It started, George Kennan at the end of World War II said, and I'm picking on America now because that's what I know and I'm an American citizen, but George Kennan at the State Department said, we have 50% of the resources and 6% of the people. We can't keep this going unless we drop a lot of bombs. So Goldwater ran for president. He said, we're going to have to drop a lot of bombs. And the American people rejected that. They said, oh, no, we're good Christians. So then Jimmy Carter came along and he said, we're good Christians. We're going to cut back on our use of resources. And the American people rejected him and said, oh, no. We want to be warm in the winter. And the Bushes came along and said, something? Y'all are good Christians. Here's your check. Don't ask questions. And we said, okie dokie.
What was the ratio again? 6% of the world's population?
Yeah, it's a very famous quote from George Kennan, and it's up on the Salieri Report. I'll find it and send it to you. We have 6% of the people and 50% of the resources. We can't keep this going without dropping a lot of bombs.
Yeah.
And in this financial coup d'etat, how many people do you think really know the whole thing?
I think you would be shocked and amazed at how few people it took. Everybody's on a need to know basis, and a lot of those people have control files. So one of my theories is I happen to believe pornography was used very astutely by the IT systems and the tech companies to get control files. And I'll tell you how. If I can get a civil servant in the account, if I can get everybody in the accounting departments watching porn on a government computer, and all I have to do is once migrate them to kiddie porn, just an underage actress, they may not even realize what they're doing. Bam, I've got a control file. I've got them on a felony. Okay, so you have all these different tactics with this technology to get control files on people, and then you get somebody to do what you need them to do, but they don't see the big picture. It's very interesting. When we first started to publish all the stuff, the information on the missing money, we would we would come out with a big thing on, you know, we found another, you know, $500 billion missing at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And all of a sudden, these huge fights would break out. And I swear, because it looks just like what used to happen on Wall Street, I swear people had helped steal, you know, they'd helped steal $1 trillion and they didn't realize it. And they weren't getting paid. And suddenly they would start complaining. They wanted a bigger bonus. Wait a minute, you know, if you got $500 billion, I went, you know, so the fights would break out. And that's why a lot of what we focus on with transparency is what can we do to bring transparency to the money that will cause those personnel fights to break out? Because, you know, the beauty of our opportunity here is if you look at who's running this, you know, they depend on force and greed. They don't have a culture that binds them. And so I believe ultimately they're going to end up killing each other. And that's why we need a plan. But if we can stop the mandates, if we can help the people who've been physically harmed, if we can stop the passports now, you know, the question is, how can we bring about a human civilization with the least pain? Right now, the pain is going to be tremendous. If they get passports and full mandates, the pain is going to be unbelievable.
So we have to stop that before it happens. It is happening already in some countries, but in other countries, it isn't. And in some of the states in the United States, I think in Florida, wasn't it Florida where a law was just recent? No, there's a decision by one of the courts, I think.
Right, you have two decisions in the Fifth Circuit. You have a South Carolina judge, a Georgia judge. I think there's something in the Sixth Circuit. But you're starting to see this momentum. And I think one of the reasons you're starting to see this momentum, and you know, I credit you guys with what you've done with helping, is for the first time in 30 years, I'm seeing a critical mass of the talent we need to create alternatives coming to the realization that it's really this bad. You know, since 1991, I have spend an enormous amount of psychological energy struggling with the fact that the really talented people you need to run the planet just can't fathom that it's this bad. And I'm very sympathetic. You know, so you pick up, you know, Kennedy's book on Fauci, and what everybody's asking is, how could it have been this bad and me not know? You know, which is a legitimate question. But now that you see the critical mass of talent we need to run the planet, realizing, you know something, I'm not going along with this for anything. I would rather, you know, I always tell people death is not the worst thing that can happen. I wouldn't want to be part of that group for anything. I call them the Midianites. I don't want to be on the Midianites team. So, you know, I'd rather die on this team than be on the Midianites team. So I think we're going to win, but you know, and my concern is I would hate to be as painful as it could be, but I wouldn't be on the Midianites team because, you know something, they're a creepy group.
Yeah, yes. Definitely. I mean, it's
quite
still,
obviously.
Look, it's still true quite what obvious. The what we have here, you know, we really just have to disconnect, you know, and so easy. It's always the same, you know. It's just a question
and
of
it's
choice.
Happening.
So I have to tell you a story. So in the last month, twice I've been rejected to eat in a restaurant because I didn't have a QR code. And when it happened, you know, I had assumed if it happened, I would feel frustrated. When it happened both times, I felt this magical feeling of, you know, it's like there's a divide going on and I'm going into this magical world. And it was really funny because the second time it happened, we had to eat outdoors and it turned into an absolutely magical experience. And it was it was wonderful because everybody in the restaurant had masks on and they looked totally miserable. So we're outside watching the prawn ships come into the port and two seals came in and I thought, this is wonderful. And I used to have a friend who would talk about a term, a South American term she called Jatino, the magic that comes in dangerous times. And it's happening to me more and more that I feel this magic that comes in dangerous times is the people who really will go to the wall for freedom come together. You know, I was in Milan and Bern when Kennedy came to speak, and it was the people in Milan and in Bern, when you get together with thousands and thousands of people, I know you guys have known this because of the big protests in Germany, but God, it just feels like you could lift off and, you know, it just feels like lift off. It's an amazing, amazing feeling. So that magic is going to work, and that's our opportunity.
Yeah, it's true. It's a whole like new quality of people, you know, like all the small talk has gone, and it's really like it's to the point, like facing the brutal facts, but still be able, you know, to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And it's I think it's a whole new energy.
And
see that also everywhere.
Yes.
And then you have the people who are stuck, you know, yesterday I went to some store where I always bought like thread yarns, you know, for my fashion business. And they were like, you know, really like timid and had masks on. You could only enter this tiny store with like 2G. So, I mean, vaccinated and
it's so important we help the people who are vaccine damaged. I think we have to do everything we can to reach out and help because, and also we have doctors and nurses now because of the mandates coming out of the system and they need to tell all and feel forgiven. We need to bring in as many people as we can and help as many people as we can sort of enjoy the delights of teaming up with us. And I think there's huge opportunity to do that because I can't tell you how sorry I feel for those people. And I appreciate that some of them are sort of locked in the media. You know, the more we can get people to turn off their TVs and go outside and look at the seals
That's
swimming
the
around the harbor, the better off we'll be.
But I think
That's
it can also
secret.
Not be hidden anymore. Yesterday, someone from Israel told me that on mainstream Israeli TV, they are now discussing the vaccine damages. And
really?
You know this film by documentary by Avital. Do you know Avital Levy? I think it was
Was
name.
That the one that had all of the people who'd been vaccinated?
Yes.
And
that
I think
was
that,
fabulous.
That also
yeah.
ran
60,
on TV,
yeah.
but then also they had, you know, now discussions about that on regular TV. And it's becoming more and more obvious. And this person told me that the Israelis are especially obsessed with saving their children from any harm. And so I think it's really this threshold that they're crossing, and I think it's now really becoming also more and more obvious to them, apart from the fact that they're realizing that they've been tricked into this vaccination circle, you know, that's not supposed to be to stop, you know, because it's the second, the third, fourth, whatever. So they're angry, plus like becoming more and more protective about their children.
Right.
Mr.
Global's tactic is to do... You know, divide and conquer is one of Mr. Global's most popular tactics, as I'm sure you know, but the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated is the new great, you know, effort to try and divide us, and we can't let that happen. And that's why if the unvaccinated or the people who've been opposed to the mandates reach out and do everything they can to help the vaccinated who've been harmed or damaged, we have to do it.
That's why we... couple of weeks ago, months ago, actually, have come up with the idea of buying a whole new hospital, or not a new one, but one of those that have been shut down. The thing is, it's too complicated to get this thing running because you have to get all these official permissions, and we're not going to get them. We will buy one, two, or even more hospitals, but that'll take too long for us to help these people who have now come to the conclusion that maybe what they're suffering from has something to do with the vaccinations. But that's the only way. You have to. This is learning the hard way, and I just hope that the so-called vaccines, in particular the mRNA vaccines, which are not just dangerous because of the very toxic spike protein, but also because they are literally shutting off your immune system.
Right.
But it's, I guess, I think there's still hope. And what we're going to do is we're setting up a network of family doctors who are then connected and who have the ability to help the people right where they are in their region, in their community.
What I get from subscribers is, you know, I'm in country X. What are the practitioners I can trust here? And that's what everybody needs to know, the practitioners. The other thing is, because when I got booted out of the establishment, I was in a political situation where I couldn't go to doctors. I couldn't go to hospitals. Part was financial, but the other part was it just politically, it wasn't safe. So I literally had to learn how to do everything yourself. And I rediscovered, you know, scads of old timey recipes. You know, I've tried everything, but I also got introduced to sort of, there's a whole underground health system in the United States of people for a variety of reasons who don't feel it's safe to go into the sort of majority hospital system. I grew up in an African American neighborhood, and that sort of church network, and you have all these old timey networks there that have passed down the technology of how to deal with these things. But anyway, one of the things, our hero of the year on the Salary Report, you know, we have a hero every week and then a hero. We had heroes of the pandemic. So Reiner, you were in the heroes of the pandemic, but our hero this week is Wim Hof. I'm a huge Wim Hof. Do you know who Wim Hof is?
You've mentioned him when we spoke on the phone.
He is a Dutch athlete who has done a lot of work with the use of cold water and ice and breathing exercises to improve health. And he's had a lot of doctors and universities now study his techniques. He's come out with a new book. And what we've done is we've bought, actually, we told people it's 50, but we bought 100 copies of his newest book, The Wim Hof Method. And what we've said is to any subscribers, as part of our Christmas donations, every Christmas we highlight a whole bunch of groups to sort of encourage donations. But we've said to the first 50 subscribers who email us and say, I've been harmed by the injections or depression related to vaccine injury or death, send me a Wim Hof book. We're going to send them, because Wim Hof believes it can help tremendously. And so we're sending them a copy of the Wim Hof. We're just about to publish an interview with him next week. And it's extraordinary the health benefits he's been able to bring to people who are struggling with inflammation and suppressed immune systems. Whether it can help in this circumstance, I don't know. But one of the things I believe is, you know, it's amazing what people can accomplish when they just try and collaborate and share their results. So I've worked a lot with vaccine families struggling with vaccine injury before COVID-19. And what they've been able to accomplish is just, you know, again and again, they've been told by the doctors that it's hopeless, and yet they accomplish miracles and it works. So I never underestimate what the human race can invent when pushed to the wall.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's not hopeless. Yeah.
It's never hopeless.
It's never hopeless because the human race is very inventive and they don't understand that. They are digitalized. They don't understand that
I think they do understand that. I think they're very concerned about maintaining control. And, you know, we're coming up into a huge shift in consciousness. You know, we're coming into a shift in consciousness where we can run the enforcement of the rule of law by culture globally, you know, to a very high extent. And we don't need all these hierarchies of control anywhere to the same extent, particularly given the wealth that can be created from these kinds of technologies. So, you know, and there's a risk management issue that's very, very serious to be sure. But I can understand why they want to get complete control now before this shifts out of control.
Yeah, it's a very like crucial point in time, you know. And in Germany, I just saw an interview or like a speech someone gave at a demonstration, like a double vaccinated person, you know, and he was really reaching out to the unvaccinated, mostly at the demonstration. And he said, you know, I can feel that I'm here with like real human beings. And I really absolutely hate this situation, you know, that's happening to democracy. And I feel this is a fascist situation. You know, that person said that clearly. And right. Everyone, of course, was like happy that he was speaking out on behalf of the unvaccinated. And I think there's also a push of solidarity from the vaccinated side, not even because they all feel deceited, you know, because maybe they have not realized that 100%, but just because they feel this is not what democracy is about. This is not what we want as human beings. So,
well, remember, the passports will be used to strip the assets and rights of the vaccinated as well as the unvaccinated.
Yeah. And so, there's practically no difference between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, because the vaccinated are soon to be the new unvaccinated, because if they don't get their booster shots, then they're back to where they were when they started. I mean, this is something that is making them very, very nervous. So I think the most important thing is transparency. So we have to continue to expose everything, including what we're talking about now with you, because this is the one of the most important aspects.
Go
ahead.
Transparency, but take action. So
take action.
What
but you can only take action if you understand what's going on.
Correct. So first you need a map. You can't drive, you know, I can't drive to Berlin without a good map, an accurate map. But don't think that you're unimportant. You are very important. Your bank deposits, your purchases, your investments, your taxes. One of the things we're going to have to do is our tax dollars are being spent illegally. And we need to move our tax dollars back into lawful management. So let me tell you one story. When I settled the litigation, I got a large settlement in. And at that point, I tried to pay off all the existing creditors who hadn't been paid off. And I owed one of the large New York Fed member banks $14,000 on a credit card. And at that point, the missing money, which is now $65,000 per person, was $14,000 per person. And I wrote them a letter and I said, I owe you $14,000, but you owe me $14,000. And I'm asserting a common law right of offset, something that the Department of Justice had taught me about. I'm asserting a common law right of offset, and I'm offsetting my $14,000 against your $14,000. And if you have a problem with that, here's the name and number of my attorney. Please feel free to contact her, and we can, you know, proceed to negotiate and litigate this issue. They wrote off the debt. I never heard another word. Now, a smart financial person would say they probably got me back on my credit score, and I can't tell you that they didn't. But that, you know, between offsets against the banks or escrows of taxes under some kind of local, you know, serious stewardship and management to ensure that our tax dollars go lawfully. I just finished publishing with my attorney a very large piece. If you go to ourmoney.solari.com, it's a very large piece on the U.S. taxation system and different ideas of how we could affect escrowing our tax dollars or doing offsets against the banks to start to claw back the money that's been disappeared. And I would encourage you to think about this, because if we're going to integrate the health side with the money side, it's all kind of come down to the fact that we, through our taxes, are financing this kind of criminal behavior, and that must be addressed. So when we go back at them on the health issues, you know, so for example, I always tell the mothers whose kids have been vaccine damaged, I said, don't go to the school board and talk science. Go to the school board, audit their books and records. I assure you they're in violation of multiple provisions, and get them on the money. Just like you can get the federal government on the fact that they're not obeying the financial management laws. I mean, the Fed's got Al Capone on taxes, not on criminality, right? So we have to integrate our pushback with the money, because if we're financing the people who are killing us and poisoning us, you know, there are no solutions until we deal with that financing.
Absolutely. We have to stop them from grabbing our taxpayers' money. We've been thinking about that, in particular with our most important legal advisor, Professor Martin Schwab. He's come up with some pretty good ideas, but others have as well.
Can you send, I'm going to send you a link to that article. It's ourmoney.solari.com. And just click on the taxation, with or without representation. Now, that's the U.S. tax system, but I happen to believe a lot of the, you know, sort of legal analysis and discussions will inform any country in the G20.
Very good. I'm going to check it out. Well, this was great, Catherine.
It's always great to talk to you guys. I can't tell you how deeply I appreciate it. You know, when I say we have all this incredible talent now jumping in to help, it's what one of the guys who was leading the Swift referendum said to me last Christmas. He said, friends are turning up everywhere.
You know, real that, friends for a change.
Real friends. And that is the magic that comes in dangerous times. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I hope you have a great day.
You
Thanks
too,
so much.
Catherine.
Fantastic.
This is not the last time. We'll speak again. This is really, really great.
Okay, you have to, well, care, next Catherine. Summer, if you can, you all have to come up here and go sailing with us. Okay.
That's no problem. Yeah. I'm from, do that. Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Thanks again.
Bye then.
Bye-bye.